tweet at TodaySOR.
This year marks the centenary of the height of the War of Independence. The conflict in Ireland in 1920 became increasingly brutal and polarising as the year progressed, with serious consequences for civilians, soldiers and politicians as Anglo-Irish relations became poisoned. So just what was really going on during that war in 1920 and how should it be remembered 100 years on? With me now, Diarmaid Ferreter, Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD. Thanks indeed for coming in again, Diarmaid. I suppose there's no escaping this, given recent controversies. What was the significance of the recruitment of the Black and Tans a century ago this month? I mean, who were they and where did they come from?
Well, there was a big dilemma for the British military and political authorities in relation to what was going on in Ireland in 1919 and 1920. By the end of 1919, it was clear that the RIC was under siege as a police force. And the political perspective on this from David Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister, was that counterinsurgency in Ireland was a policeman's job. But what he's hearing from Dublin Castle, the centre of British administration in Dublin, is that the police can't do this on their own. And there's debate going on about whether there could be the formation of some kind of force to augment the Royal Irish Constabulary. That's where the idea came from, and eventually it gets approval exactly 100 years ago this month, and then the first of the Black and Tans arrive in March. They weren't, of course, the sweepings of the British jail system, as per Republican propaganda at the time. They were mostly young, unmarried, Protestant, working-class men who were mercenary soldiers, effectively. But they were supposed to be police, of course. You know, they were augmenting
English
the Royal
Irish
Constabulary. Yeah, well, one of the really surprising things, they were English in the main, British in the main, but one of the really surprising things was the research of William Lowe, who was a historian who went through the registers, the recruitment registers, and he looked at every fifth recruit. So he ended up looking at over 2,000, and 19% of the individuals he identified were Irish. And that certainly caused quite a stir at the time, that kind of finding. But it's a reminder, of course, of the dangers of distorting and simplifying the backgrounds to those individuals. So they arrived in March, very cursory training. They're not trained as policemen. They suffer from a lack of discipline, and people will be well aware of their excesses and some of the brutalities that were experienced in 1920. But they're part of this wider picture. And for the British government, of course, what you really need is engagement with the Irish question. I mean, the Black and Tans were a political creation, and their political masters had to take responsibility for them. But in truth, there was very little attention devoted by British politicians to Ireland. And we have to remember that they considered that they had much more important matters to be dealing with.
And to what extent were they recruited in order to fill the gaps left by people who, for political or maybe reasons of intimidation, who had resigned or left their position
in the
RIC?
Absolutely, that's part of it. You know, and there were many who had left the Royal Irish Constabulary, either through conviction or because they were forced to do so. But there was also the desertion of the barracks. I mean, the IRA very effectively targeted the IRA or the RIC barracks in 1919 and into 1920. They're very vulnerable, many of those barracks in remote parts of the country, and they're easily attacked. But the other interesting point about, you know, that scene and that atmosphere, which is becoming increasingly fraught in 1920, is that Dermot O'Hegarty, who was the secretary to the Sinn Féin government, the underground government at the time, had announced that those who were in the RIC were to be treated as people who were guilty of treachery. So, you know, that really increases the tension and the dilemmas for RIC members. And what you're getting over the course of 1920, of course, is increasingly aggressive military striking and military activity by the IRA as well. And I mean, this isn't about the vindication of an astute master plan by the IRA. It depends on what part of the country they're in and what access to arms they have and what kind of support they can rely on from
and
the community.
Remind us, Diarmaid, about some of the key moments of 1920. The death of the Lord Mayor of Cork, Terence McSweeney, from hunger strike in prison, but that had followed on from a previous assassination.
Yeah, Michael Collins wrote a very interesting letter in 1920 in which he said real progress is to be estimated by what is thought abroad as much as by what is thought at home. And the example of Terence McSweeney was an interesting one there. I mean, it was a harrowing death. 74 days on hunger strike in Brixton prison, the Lord Mayor of Cork. This received international attention. There was very little knowledge about how long someone could last on hunger strike 100 years ago, and nobody expected him to survive for 74 days, and it built up expectation. And there was an intense media focus on it. And of course, you know, physically and psychologically, this was a horrendous ordeal, but it was a propaganda boon for the Republican movement because of the international attention on the Irish question and, of course, the logistics around his funeral, but also that he was a public representative. And, of course, he provided inspiration also later to some Indian nationalists. And some of his words, of course, went down in history. It's not those who inflict the most, but those who endure the most who will prevail.
Which were drawn upon, of course, in the 80s with the
IRA. Oh, very much. You can see them reaching back to that.
And prior to that, of course, you had the burning of Cork.
The burning of Cork came in December 1920. That was the greatest act of vandalism during the War of Independence. 40 businesses, 300 homes destroyed, 2,000 people lost their jobs. These were drunken auxiliaries who went on the rampage in retaliation for an IRA ambush.
Just explain the difference between the auxiliaries and the Black and Tans.
Very important distinction. They're different forces. The Black and Tans, as we mentioned earlier on, were there to augment the Royal Irish Constabulary. And the auxiliaries are an elite strike force. They're much smaller in number. They're demobilised officers. So they come from the officer class, unlike the Black and Tans, and they're paid more than double the Black and Tans. They're paid £7 a week, the auxiliaries. They never numbered more than about 2,600. They're under the control of Frank Crozier, who has fierce problems, of course, trying to discipline and actually dismiss some of them who were then reinstated. And the idea was that, in the words of Neville Macready, who was the overall commander of the British forces in Ireland, they would take the fight to the IRA. So they have different methods. And, you know, those individuals, Neville Macready, Henry Tudor, Chief of Police, Crozier and the auxiliaries, there isn't a unified security or military command in Ireland in 1920. And it's one of the problems from the British side.
Another key moment in 1920, the hanging of the 18-year-old medical student Kevin Barry. And that had an influence on Michael Collins, did it not?
It had an influence on them all. I mean, this was the first conviction under the Restoration of Order in Ireland Act, the first execution since 1916. But it was the fact that he was 18-year-old, an 18-year-old, a mere boy, as he was
just
referred to at the time.
Just a lad of 18 summers.
A lad of 18. He was a student in UCD. He was involved in an ambush in Dublin, an IRA ambush, in which three British soldiers, who weren't much older than Kevin Barry, were killed. And again, this generated international attention, partly because he was a middle-class boy as well. And we know behind the scenes that people like William Walsh, the Catholic Archbishop of Dublin, were making representations for a reprieve. And the response of General Neville Macready was that we can't show leniency in this case because of the impact it would have on the morale of the troops. So that was a very, very high-profile execution. And again, it did enormous damage to Britain's...
Yeah, but did, when I said the influence on Collins, I mean, to what extent did it lead directly, say, to Bloody Sunday?
No, you can't see it like that. I mean, it is obviously there by the second half of 1920. There are so many reprisals. Mm. There are so many different events. There are so many different outrages that they accumulate, and then the concern of the IRA is that they will be penetrated. You know. And what Collins was seeking to achieve on Bloody Sunday was to try and get them before they got to the IRA, to try and wipe out British intelligence in Ireland. And you had those killings in the morning, of course. 7 of them killed in their pyjamas at various locations around Dublin and the others in their boarding houses. And then the retaliation in Croke Park. And then after Croke Park, you had IRA prisoners who were killed. What happened, Sean, on Bloody Sunday was that 30 people were killed in Dublin in the space of 15 hours. It was a turning point. Again, huge international interest, great embarrassment for Britain. But there was also a lot of revulsion at what the IRA had done as well.
And a week later, was it, what became known as the Kilmichael ambush happened in County
Cork. This is Tom
Cork.
Barry's flying column in Cork, one of the biggest in the country. And Cork, of course, was the most violent county in the country. 17 auxiliaries were killed. Three IRA members were also killed, but 17 auxiliaries. That was an enormous success for the IRA. There has been controversy ever since about whether these auxiliaries had surrendered and were then killed. We don't have conclusive proof of exactly what happened on that day. But again, it went down in history as another one of these turning points. Again, horrific killings. But it raised this vital question. Was the British government's insistence that they had murder by the throat, in the words of David Lloyd George, the Prime Minister in 1920, was that a complete and utter delusion? And there's pressure behind the scenes by the end of 1920 to try and generate some kind of dialogue. 2 days before Bloody Sunday, C.J. Phillips in the British Foreign Office had referred to a slender link that had been established with Republican contacts, the more moderate Republicans like Arthur Griffith. And there was then, as a result of Bloody Sunday, as a result of Kilmichael, there was a drawing back from some of that. But there is shuttle diplomacy. Archbishop Clune, Patrick Clune, who was a Clare man, who was the Archbishop of Perth in Australia, whose nephew had been killed on Bloody Sunday. He begins shuttle diplomacy between Sinn Féin and the British government. It doesn't bear fruit by the end of 1920 in terms of an end to violence, but it is the beginning of a recognition that the long-term objectives and nature of this conflict have to be reassessed. And of course, it takes another 8 months before we get a ceasefire. But there is a change by the end of 1920.
And going back to where we started, controversy recently in which you were part yourself about the now abandoned, or at least, sorry, postponed plan to...
Probably abandoned, Sean, I would think.
Members of the RIC. I mean, you've always believed yourself that there should be an academic emphasis on that.
I just thought these issues are very fraught. You know, you have to tread carefully. You're dealing with matters of, you know, loyalty and service and terror and identity in Ireland in 1920 and even 100 years on. You know, there are very strong views held on all of those issues. And what the state chooses to formally commemorate is of great significance. And you've got to be mindful that commemoration is a construct of the time it's being devised in. You know, the winds of current affairs have a huge impact on commemoration and the environment that exists at the time the events are being commemorated. And sometimes less is more effective when it comes to commemoration. You don't want events that will generate this polarisation and this coarseness and this distortion and simplification of history and generate protests that would be embarrassing and humiliating. We need to try and deal with this maturely, and sometimes it is better to get people together to discuss and debate and to tease out the nuance. You know, and that plant of nuance has been cultivated over many years now. And it can be uprooted very, very quickly, not just here, but also in the north of Ireland. And even with this new power sharing arrangement that's come in, there's a document there that refers specifically to the commemoration of the foundation of the state of Northern Ireland in 1920. It's a tricky issue in both parts of the island, and it calls for responsible political leadership, but also meaningful consultation.
OK, we leave it there for now. Dermot Ferreter, Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD. Thanks for coming in. Our gathering is next.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.